everyone. Welcome to an exclusive episode of Hail Discordia, which is going to be a panel called Authorship and Visibility, broadcasting live on CIDR 101.9 FM Vancouver, which is the traditional, ancestral, and unceded land of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. I am Hannah, and I'm the spoken word coordinator at CIDR. I'm in the studio right now providing a supporting role to the wonderful panelists and our spectacular host for today, Zhenyu, who are all joining us on Zoom. Hi, Zhenyu. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Yeah, of course. Hi, Hannah. Thank you for the introduction and welcome everybody to our panel. This is the first ever panel that we've ever had on Hail Discordia. And if you listen to our first episode, you would know that my name is Xinyue and I came to Canada to pursue my Master's of Fine Art degree at Simon Fraser University. And now that I've graduated, I decided to do something meaningful with my free time. Unfortunately, my partner Sam won't be joining us anymore, but I'm happy to stay here and continue helping our local artist friends to publish their work and have a platform to speak their own voice. So that's me.
Awesome. I will give a little sort of intro. I'll try to do my best to do justice to Hail Discordia. It is a one-stop shop radio for Discorder magazine, and I'm so excited for today's panel and to get a behind-the-scenes look on the creative process that goes into making art, writing, etc. So I am going to do the land honoring now. As I mentioned, this panel is taking place on the unceded, meaning stolen, ancestral, and traditional lands of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. Media practices are often rooted in white gaze and colonial narratives. To be truly ethical in our journalism, we need to be actively rethinking and decolonizing media practices, as well as shifting our approach by moving towards radical empathy and anti-racist lens and supporting Indigenous sovereignty. While CIDR 101.9 FM broadcasts from UBC Vancouver campus, our listenership extends to the unceded lands of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh nations and beyond. We encourage you to check out native-land.ca to learn more about whose land and territory you live and work on or maybe visiting. We are having a bit of technical difficulty, so I'm going to play some PSAs right now.
Celebrate Earth Day with the soundscape from the Tektexan wetland on unceded Wasanic territory, Saturna Island, British Columbia. Follow the 24-hour circadian rhythm as it unfolds in sync with your local time. The voices of the frogs, birds, insects, and their environment take over the airwaves for this experience in slow radio. The wetland broadcast is created by artists Brady Marks and Mark Timmix. Crack open a virtual window and connect your everyday activities to the wetland soundscape. April 22nd, all day, Earth Day. To learn more, visit wetlandproject.com.
About 40% of UBC students experience food insecurity. Sprouts is hosting a weekly produce market from 10:30 to 1:30.
Okay, so it seems like Zoom was really acting up on my end, but we're back, and I hope nothing happens again. And yeah, I just did the line acknowledgement, and I'm going to pass it on to Zhenyu to introduce the panel and our very talented panelists.
Thank you, Hannah. So I suppose we can go with whichever order that everybody prefer. From what I can see, I'm starting, perhaps we can start with Milena, then pass on to Ricky, and then Basha.
We introduced ourselves? Okay. Hi, my name is Milena. My pronouns are she, her. I'm in my last year studying poli-sci at UBC, about to graduate. Woo, excited about it. And in most, if not all, of my free time, I like to write poetry, prose, and it's just like, more than anything, it's a really good or fun habit that I've kept throughout the years, and something that I'd like to pursue now that I have all the time in the world to do so. And with Discorder magazine, I tend to write interviews, sometimes like long form. Usually it ends up being longer than I anticipated, but what can I say? I like language. So that's me. Oh, and I'm Chilean Canadian. So yeah, that's me.
Thank you, Milena.
Hi. Yeah, there's going to be, because of the rain, there might be a little bit of background rain noise, and I apologize for that. But
yeah, well, this is Hail Discordia.
Oh, perfect. I'm so glad that it's mood setting. Yeah, so I'm Ricky Castanedo Laredo. I am the art director of Discorder magazine and the art coordinator for CITR 101.9 FM. I'm the graphic designer, visual person, and I'm probably the longest running art director now, which is a funny thing to admit on radio. and my role has been primarily to provide photographers and illustrators of all experience levels an opportunity to be published and to like work in some capacity with a publication. And I wish I could like throw up like the biggest air quotes on that sometimes, because this quarter is really unique, but in how it exists as a publication, I think. But all this to say is like that's what I do, and I really enjoy it. I really enjoy doing that.
Thank you, Ricky. Let's move on to Basha.
Hi there. My name is Basha Ahmed-El-Hindi. I guess I could say I've been a poet and short story writer for a very long time now. I took it in school, blah, blah, blah. I've been published in a bunch of different small presses and larger across Canada, such as Poetry is Dead, a Vancouver lit supplement that is now gone, a couple post-secondary out of Montreal, and lately, or lastly, Discordia. Yeah, I've had like 1,000 other jobs in the meantime, so I guess I'm here today to talk about writing and how it defines you, but also how it can be a part of you without being everything. My pronouns are any, I am Egyptian, and that's all I got.
Wonderful, wonderful. Thank you, everybody. I should also preface the episode by saying the theme, or perhaps the title of this panel, is called Authorship and Visibility. And it's really interesting that Basha, you should mention the one of the magazine that you publish your work. It's called Poetry is Dead. I did write this little introduction for the show, and I will read it, and perhaps that will launch us into some questions. Okay, so writing is a destruction of every voice, of every point of origin, wrote Roland and Barthes in 1977, positing that an author's voice is lost, hidden, eclipsed by the words they produce. A writer is written off by their work. We're here today not with the ambition to revive any such an author, but to consider the possibility of finding ways to coexist with our creation during difficult times. Or with some ambition, try and live through our creative practice and to see the significance beyond it. In today's episode, we'll hear from three local individuals who contribute to the Discorder magazine in the form of text, images, and directorial skills to discuss the fascinating relationship between authorship and visibility. So I hope that provides a bit of foundation for today's episode. So personally, I'm really interested about this idea of visibility and how is an author realized through their writing. So how can you foreground your personhood or your identity through writing? So I guess I'll start by asking everybody, how did you come across the magazine and what motivated you to contribute to the magazine? It's a free discussion. Anybody can start.
I found my first copy of Discorder once I moved into Chinatown a couple years ago, and or Discorder in a sense. And with any sort of free press, there's always that moment. I mean, I grew up in Toronto where there was a lot more free press on the streets. There's like three different versions of the Georgia Strait in and of itself, and a couple smaller presses through Ryerson and OCAD and so forth that are also free and containing specifically the kind of stuff that normally you would have to go to a bookstore and hunt, whether it's, you know, art in paper form, you know, in photograph, whatever, writing, etc., reviews. And I guess it stood out to me because it was so well designed and very beautiful and had like a lot of little pieces to it that felt outside of the norm and not just kind of, what's the word? It wasn't pedestrian in any way. And I had a moment where I was like, I haven't submitted in a while. I should do that because I'm an older writer. And at some point in time, if you're not on that dedicated track to being like, okay, I've done this book, I'm gonna write my next book, or I'm actively doing it, you tend to forget. Maybe you work on your stuff, you don't even share any of your work for a long period of time. I knew a few people involved in the project, including Ricky kind of by proxy, and was like, maybe this is a good place for my work. And it was, and I now have a physical copy of it, which I think to any writer is kind of the most important thing in the world, even if it is just a newspaper, because you can like have a few drinks and rub it in somebody's face and be like, look what I did, which I obviously have done several times, and I have six copies of the one that I was published in. That answers the question pretty well.
Thank you. Super awesome. Yeah, I like the idea of having a physical copy as some sort of concrete evidence of your identity as an author of some sort. And I hope you were giving out your copies to your friends as well.
Oh, of course. I'm not just a full hoarder. I gave one to everyone that mattered. And then I guess I kept a few just because I was like, maybe one day I'll meet people, or like, I don't know, maybe, I mean, this is a total pipe dream, but like, it's good to have a copy of everything you've ever published. I can't say that I do, but just for, you know, your own personal kind of catalog.
I agree with that. I'm as a designer, I keep a copy of everything I've ever designed that makes it into the physical world. There's just so much about what Basha was saying that I wanted to like jump in on, but I also didn't want to stop the thought because it was such a, I think it really encompasses a lot of the vision that went into Discorder. And, you know, like Discorder has mutated over the years, but I think recently or in its most current form, I think it really tries to do that, to create kind of a space for you to try something new or try something that you haven't done in a while, or, you know, just kind of an opening. It creates an opening for you to then see it to the end, right? Which is not the case with a lot of other submission-based or free publications. We aren't perfect in the sense that like, we don't have endless room. We can't publish everybody. So we do have to select to some degree, but all in all, the idea that like, it's not really about, like, it's just a place you can go to do the thing that you want to do rather than like the thing that we expect from you. And I like that. So, and in terms of keeping physical copies, I mean, in a world where like the digital world is, you know, I'm not going to vilify it. It's a huge component of why we succeed now is probably because we have web presence, right? And it's, but there's still something to be said for something that continues to exist physically, because physical copies, free press is still some of the most accessible ways to read or to get news, right? Like it's doesn't require anything but for you to pick it up and be able to read. So just so yeah, I think it's worth keeping things in the real world when you can.
Thank you for sharing, Ricky. Milena, I can't help but noticing that your current major, one that you're about to graduate from, is actually quite far away from what one would consider to be a traditional writing practice, or like it's quite far from creative writing because you're in political science. So what prompted you into writing? Has it always been you feel, or is it something that developed throughout the program or your upbringing?
Yeah, that's a cool question. I think that it's always been there. And I think that in poli-sci or in like a lot of humanities courses, it's mostly like, you know, you got to know how to write papers and most of your, I'm not really good with like tests, but I've always kind of like, yeah, just had more of an affinity for writing. And it's really interesting hearing, Ricky and Basha talk about having physical copies, because I remember how much I appreciated just even connecting it to your question in class, like having a pen and a paper and being able to just like feel like that was, I don't know, like the physical act of writing was important and always has been. And I think that can connect to a lot of other mediums like drawing, collaging, whatever it may be. But I think that it's a way of, yeah, not only just getting your thoughts out, but collecting things and holding collections. And like Basha said very nicely, I liked how you said a catalog of yourself. I have a binder in my room, and it's probably the only like mild sense of organization that I hold, where it's like I have all of the Discorder magazines and I have them in their little pockets. And I'm like, oh, well, my life's a mess, but at least my magazines are organized. I think I steered off your question, but yes, politics makes its way everywhere, I have to say. Political science, like, you know, in the science part, yeah, I don't know, but the politics part is like everywhere. Every person in my daily life, it makes its way, because it's just power and everyone deals with different layers of power in their life and as a person.
I think writing as an act is both performative and powerful, and I think what really interests me is also this idea of we realize a different self through writing or through having a different channel outside of what we do normally. And I sense that's the case with a lot of you sitting here, or by your identity as like your 9-to-5 normal day job is quite different from writing. So writing exists as an out of the body kind of a different experience. And at the same time, and just this will tie back to Ricky. Ricky, it must be so gratifying to hear someone talking about treasuring their published Discorder magazine and looking at them with so much admiration, I suppose. So what is it like for you to be a coordinator, a director, to help so many authors? What is the selecting process, actually? How do you find these authors?
Are you gonna pull behind the veil like that? Okay, well, I wanted to jump in earlier, but say, like, I'm just so glad I'm not the only crazy weirdo that puts things in little sleeves and keeps copies of it, because in my, I have 3 copies of every single magazine that I ever designed. That's a lot, because I've been in this job for like 6 years or so. So it's really nice to hear that other people feel that, because I'm really proud of what I get to do. And because it's, you know, in a lot of ways, I think what Discorder did for me at the time that I joined, which is I joined as the art director years ago, when it was a position that was like honoraria based, and it was like $200 maybe, and I did everything. Like, it was just like coordinating, designing it, like getting it printed, going, like, it was nuts. And it's just become such a big part of my life that I thought I treasured it because of the, out of ego in a way, but it's not really that. It's that I get to really create something. I get to be a part of something that I feel really is about everyone else involved. Like, I get to make it nice, sure. And in that, in the design, you can't miss that it's something that I've made, I guess. But at the same time, like, I really try not to select illustrators or photographers based on anything beyond them. Like, this person wants to take a photo. Let's see what they got. Let's give them a photo shoot to do. Or, I always ask for samples of people's work, not because I'm trying to see like how skilled you are. It's simply because I want to know what you like drawing, how you like to draw, what kind of vibe you want to go with, right? Because I think one of the things that I like, truly one of the big tasks of my job is like, I need to be able to make you shine. And so I need to find a way to put you in a place where your work, whether it's a digital masterpiece that you vectorize and it's like perfect for print, or it's a scan from a notebook, like my job is to put it somewhere where it makes sense and it looks good, and it showcases what's the beauty of that work, because it's never about just technique. It's never about it's about the, I don't know, it's like the poetry of being able to illustrate something, right? And I think I talk about illustration photography because it's my world, not Tasha deals with the words, but I suspect it's a very similar thing for Tash. I know that writing wise, she also only ever looks for samples for people because she's trying to figure out like, what do you like, right? What excites you to write about? Because we want to give you something that's exciting for you so that you put forth your best work. And so that's, I don't know, that's very rewarding. Sounds very paternal, but it is very rewarding.
I don't think that's necessarily paternalistic. I do hear you being very selfless in this process. I think the story of how you just took on this job, even though it pays so little, is fascinating. And I think this is something that we all face as creative people, because a lot of times you are in a situation where you basically get nothing out of it, other than the sense of having accomplished something perhaps for yourself and then for others. I think that's, for me at least, if I could do my part and make other people's life a little bit better. I mean, it sounds very idealistic, but I do think that's something that motivates me at least personally. But I guess in terms of juggling between different jobs and trying to squeeze in your creative practice somewhere, I'm sure Basha and Milena, you both have something to say about this. Basha, actually, you said you have, what, 1,000 other jobs at the same time. What is that like?
No, I have had 1,000 other jobs while trying to be a writer since I was 18. So there's a definite note. Like, I came out of school and was like, I'm going to do this. Like, I'm going to become a published poet. I'm going to get I'm going to get a collection out, and I'm going to get my name out there. And I got published a couple times in that first year, and it paid me $0 over and over again. And I was like, this is really cool. I have these physical copies of what I've done and no money. And then you start to look to where, and like, I'm at a place now, you know, 16 years later, where I'm like, I have to write a movie script because there's no way for me to even think about the gradual accumulation of my work we could get into a much further debacles with this, such as self-publishing and what the world of publishing looks like right now, and if anyone makes any money anywhere. But it definitely starts to kind of beget this theory that as much as it might be the most pure thing to you, drawing, creating, designing, it also has to become second fiddle to something that puts food on the table, as well as keeps you healthy. I think that's another total, like, we'll get into that in later questions, but like, I love being a writer, but as if you've read any of my work, and you'll get to hear something later, sometimes it's really hard also just being in that mind state forever, because you're like, I need to watch some comedy after this, or like I can't just write about, you know, disestablishmentarianism or you know, the death of the bourgeoisie, or how we're all broke and very depressed and riddled with mental illness. I have to do something funny or happy today. So I think it's just this constant spiral of like, we all figured out at some point in time that we have this ability and this gift, but there's so much more than what fits into that box, you know, like putting food on the table, making sure our mental health is taken care of. And, you know, so that we have a secondary direction, because like, apart from very, especially within the realm of poetry, apart from very few people, like 3 out of 8 billion, most people will never be able to afford a life in putting together something as simple as poetry. So that's where I'll get off my soapbox and pass the mic.
Milana, is there something that you would like to add?
You know, I write on napkins sometimes. Like when I worked at my coffee shop, I shouldn't just segue. I think that what's really interesting about like this panel too is that we're all at like different points. So it's like, it's really cool to like hear, I mean, I don't know what the publishing fish tank looks like right now. It looks like it's really, yeah, I don't know. So it's like really, it's really interesting to hear all these different perspectives. What was I gonna say? Your initial question was about like if we find like how do we find time to write outside of our like other jobs or gigs? And I think that the first thing that came to my mind was like, yeah, like I don't know, like just being like, yeah, I worked at I've worked at different coffee shops, and like, yeah, writing on napkins and like writing on receipts and finding, yeah, just things like that. But that's really it. I don't know.
Thank you. All of you all had something really interesting to say. And then I'm very intrigued by this idea of self-publishing, or perhaps just using writing as something that you do to help yourself grow in a way. I don't really know what it's like to pursue writing as a full-on career. Perhaps, you know, I can't say a few things about it because I am going to do a fine art degree. And then that seems very utopic in a way, where I'm pursuing this castle in the sky, and it isn't something that is very down to earth and perhaps will bring me a lot of money or wealth in a traditional sense. But I think it's nice to have that kind of passion. Without passion, I don't see the meaning to life in a way. So I think perhaps creativity can help us fulfilling that part of ourselves. And that lead to another question. So what do you think is the relationship between writing or just creativity and reality? Do you think writing can represent reality faithfully, or does writing produce a different kind of reality, or perhaps make it less meaningful in a way? Can that happen?
Holy smokes, like there's just like so much to there's so much ground to cover in what you said. Even before the question, because I was, it got me thinking about like, you know, where we put value and how we engage in our everyday life. So I know this is about writing, I apologize for coming in here with some floofy ideas, but here I go, which is like, I spent a lot of time thinking about like, what am I like, you know, because I think we all have that moment of like, as writers, as artists, as designers, whatever the, you know, like we are constantly wondering like, what is my title? Like if I had a placard that goes on a desk somewhere, like what would it read? It would read Ricky Castanet-Loretto, and then underneath, what would it be? Right. And I arrived at artist, right. Which is like, sounds so disingenuous to think about it that way, but I've come around to it. Not only because I went to art school, and so to some degree, maybe I have jurisdiction just based on a piece of paper somewhere that tells me that I did good at art. But I spent a lot of time thinking about like, does it mean to be an artist? And to be an artist doesn't mean that you know how to paint or knows how to write or you know how to design a poster. To me, being an artist means that you know how to engage with the world artistically. You know how to engage creatively and I don't know, maybe even from a point of exploration, right? Like pulling the veil back, like my job currently at CITR is still that of a graphic designer. And I'm very privileged to have a job that, to work for an organization that pretty much says like, hey, Ricky, we need a poster and I just get to do whatever I want. That's not the truth for a lot of designers in the world. But I'm not even talking, but my job is also a 3-day job, right? It's not a full-time job, as Basha was saying. It's like, you know, we find other ways to supplement our lives. But at the end of the day, it's like, I still choose to not only believe that when I design, it's the only moment that I get to be an artist or that I get to be who I am, right? Like my other job is I'm a cook and I get to engage with food in a very artistic way, you know, and it sounds like super trite, like some like, Anthony Bourdain stuff, but it's true, right? Like we engage with, when we make something, when we create, we engage with our creativity. It's a power that all of us have, and choosing to engage with that, like you can make a cup of coffee an artistic experience if that's what you want, and people do. And you know, we have like coffee shops like Revolver that their whole thing is the artistic expression of coffee, right? And and you know, sometimes it's pretentious as hell and sometimes it's real. And I don't know why I really wanted to bring that up, because I do think that it's like we sometimes get stuck in this divide between like, I can't be an artist in my day job, or I can't, like, I'm an artist in my off hours. And I want people to embrace, no, you're an artist always, even if what you're doing isn't particularly artistic. Yeah.
Yeah, perhaps I think it makes a lot of sense. Maybe it's even reductive to prescribe this label of an artist, because then you will be, sometimes it's like the boundary of an artist is really clear, and what we should be doing is to dismantle that boundary a little bit. So instead of saying one person is and isn't, perhaps what if that we're always living in the in-betweenness of being creative, and then we don't really have to restrict ourselves to a single label, then everything we're doing could take on different meaning and it could be creative infinitely. We don't have to force ourselves into fitting this role or continue to define what being an artist really means. So I that's kind of what I was thinking. Sorry, I'll pass out the mic to whoever would like to speak next.
I mean, I can always talk. Yeah, this whole question was about the identity of it. And before I spiral off on that, I want to say that like people like Ricky kind of have this nice, mean vibe to them where, especially I think once you get to a certain age as an artist, and this is going to spin off a couple of questions. You know, we come out of university or high school and we have this idea because of extraneous thought and movies and music of what it is to be a creative and what a tortured existence looks like. And then we try for like 5-10 years. Usually people throw everything they can at it. They figure a lot of painters will go through 9 different processes. They might end up as a tattoo artist. They might end up, you know, doing fine art completely, working at a gallery, or they might abandon it to work at a bar and then work on their paintings on the weekend. All of these are valid. But I think at some point in time, it creates this identity of selfhood, and this is my art, this is my gift to the world, what can I do to validate it? Then reality breaks us like a cowboy does a horse, and we go like, cool, I've been doing this for 10 years plus or minus a few, and you can Google me and 3 things show up, and I'm like, cool, 3 things on Google. And I find this with, in a sense of personhood, also the assemblage of giving and receiving. And someone like Ricky has taken this, and, you know, Tasha's a perfect example where as creatives, we also find ourselves in platforms where we can give back and where we can create actual communities surrounding, giving other people a voice and other people a place to show themselves. And that fills our cup, not as much as getting published, but it still fills our cup. And it makes us into these almost like brood mothers, whether AMAB or AFAB, of giving people chances, but also using those chances as a way to still not inflate, but, you know, like give respect to our creative identity. And I think that that's kind of a beautiful thing in a place like today, where anyone can be published, anyone can create whatever they want in the world. You know, as you've seen a lot nowadays, all you really have to do is have some money, and all of a sudden you can amplify your voice to either a product level or a level of, you know, seen art. So I think what comes with that is nice. And I wanted to thank people, Ricky and people like Ricky, for giving platforms like that to people that have almost forgotten about it. Because again, when I was talking earlier, I mentioned that like, I don't actively try to get published as much as I used to, because the sword of rejection gets sharper every year. I over obsess now, and I'll find a publication that I really like and submit like 3 times in a row, which is like a 6 to 8 month or process, because submissions will be like, we're open, we're closed, and they'll do it every couple of months. And as that blade dives in and they say, oh, well, they don't even say no anymore, they just don't reply. You have to stop thinking that you're good enough to be doing what you're doing, or maybe you're aiming into a certain place. So these kind of beautiful publications like Discorder, even like the back pages of Now Toronto, a lot of post graduate press like Casino out of Montreal, they all come from a place of wanting to give a voice in an industry or any industry that doesn't really allow it as much. And so that's kind of a beautiful thing, because at what point in time do we lose our identity in the way that we found it? Like, I think as creatives, there's a certain point in time where we kind of become self-aware that we can do this thing that we love and people will give attention to it. But how long can we hold on to that identity in the modern world, where it requires so much from us financially, you know, attention and otherwise? And I think that really starts to spiral out this whole realm of like, how long can we even afford to call ourselves artists, even if we'll be them for the rest of our lives?
A lot to unpack from there, for sure. I guess one thing that stuck out to me was that, and then anybody can answer this, but I'm wondering, is an artist still an artist if none of their work is published? In another way, what if you were just caught up in your room and maybe in your head as well, and you just infinitely produce and produce, but nothing that you produce, it can be seen by other people? Do you think that is an author an artist authenticated by their product in a way? And then also another, like perhaps a little bit irrelevant thing, I recently heard about Now, like the magazine Now, I think. It's facing a lot of crisis, actually. They relied on a lot of advertisement that are quickly withdrawing their money from the magazine. So the writers who have been contributing to that magazine, it's now facing unemployment all of a sudden. So yeah, so I don't know, just the idea of publication and art.
Yeah.
I mean, you go.
I think it's down to the definition, your own private definition of what it means to be an artist, right? Like I think there are people who get into creative practices because they want to meet people and show at galleries and they do that whole thing. And that's cool. People who can do that, honestly, what a skill. I don't have that skill. And you know, I did spend a long time as a young man or artist or whatever, like thinking that no, I am not an artist because my stuff has not shown all that much, or my, you know, my design work, you know, this is like a whole panel in itself, but like I face the divide of most people, which is like, if you're a designer, then you're not an artist, because there's this like bizarre nebulous line that people draw. Even Emily Carr is, as an art institution, continues to place it like a spike down the middle of like design is where the work and vapid happens and art is where the meaningful but unemployable happens. And I like to think that I encourage people and I encourage myself to think of like, how do I bind the two together? Why does my design work, i.e. my work that makes money, have to be so separate from the part of me that's creative and I don't know, like kind of invested in my process. So in that sense, I guess my answer is no. Like now, even, you know, my posters are around the city. I obviously designed this magazine that gets circulated. And you know what? I would argue that still not a lot of people know who I am. And I don't think that makes me any less of an artist. I think it just makes me a kind of a recluse. And that's a thing I choose for myself. So, it kind of depends, right? I also don't have much to show for it. My CV is quite limited in comparison to some of the people I have featured.
Thank you for very genuine response. I would love to hear from Basha again, because I know you you sent me some of your lovely poetry, and I would love to get one of them read by you. But before that, I think we haven't heard a lot from Milena at this point. So I guess I'm just wondering, being on this panel and listening to all of this, perhaps behind the scene publication details, what do you feel about your next stage of creative practice? Do you want to keep publishing? And if you want to do that, do you see yourself growing with the magazine, or perhaps you want to branch out and develop your writing into a different kind of form? I'm just curious.
Yeah. Just some thoughts from the last question too. I could probably put them in here, but I think that a lot of, or like a huge part of being an artiste is sharing your art, and just like that idea of sharing, and like, you know, you make something, and I think that that's the art, and then like the other part is like, yeah, I don't know, like putting it on the table in your house, outside, I don't know. And I think that you know, because I think that there's that also like that there's that other part of being an artist where it's like you have your own, like you get to read your own work, but then it's like someone picks up the mag and like reads it, and then they have their own relationship with the art, like a second or third time. And that's on its own too though, right? Like it's not like I know every time that someone else reads my work, or if they ever do, but it's just kind of that idea of like putting something out there. But obviously there's like a lot of blocks from like publishing perspectives of like, well, we're, you know, sometimes they'll say no, we won't put it out there. In terms of, yeah, to answer your question, I would say that I am more like so looking to grow as an artist and like being able to like more openly share my work, because it feels really, yeah, like sometimes I, you know, I get really shy and like I'm like, no, this is horrible. Like, why would I ever, and even when I do publish things, I'm like, I can't read that anymore. Like, I can't read what I wrote. I'm not looking at that page. That didn't, yeah, happen. And then other times I, you know, like this last issue, I felt like really happy with it. Have I like read it again? No, I just can't sometimes, because I don't know. So I don't know, like that whole like process internally that I deal with myself and I hear other people are kind of, it's good, it's validating. It's like, okay, so it's not just me. But yeah, I think I think it's also like just, I just want to like learn how to be more confident with my work and be able to share it and not feel so bad about it all the time. And I don't know if that's like artist vibe, like a thing, or just like a human thing, but that's my next goal. And I don't know if it's going to be necessarily in this quarter or in something else, but we'll see what happens.
That's really lovely. Yeah. And then I know I started this show by quoting Roland Barthes because I'm a hopeless academic. I'm so sorry. But I do want to say from what you just said, I was reminded of the last line from that same paper, Death of the Author, that the birth of the reader must be at the cost of the death of the author. So that what you're saying about your work being outside of your control and circulating in the world and touching people, perhaps even without you noticing it, I think that itself is a beautiful idea, that you've created something, be it physically or perhaps intangibly, and then that people can pick it up anywhere, anytime, and then they might develop a different relationship with your work, and that is beyond your perhaps knowledge or scope of knowing. But I don't know. I like the idea of creating this external self that is always speculating and circulating and developing different forms. That's
terrifying though. Like what? Like you all over the place, and you like you just put it out there, and it's like you can't control. Like right now, I'm choosing my words. I chose the shirt I'm wearing. Like all this stuff. But like once you have like yourself, yeah. What multiple me's? That's crazy. And then like yeah. But also, I'd like to say that yeah, it's really cool that, you know, there's magazines that will say, yes, we will publish you. And then you feel like, oh, like what? That's crazy. Like that's nice. Like it feels good. It feels like you are like, especially like as a young, like whoever, what if you're young, old, like it feels nice to kind of get like that sort of that sense of it's okay. And you have a space and your words are here, which is cool. So that's important.
Yeah, having faith in yourself and in your word baby, your product. Yeah, so yeah, awesome. right, so we have 10-ish minutes left. So I would love for, if Basha, if you don't mind, could you please read us your poem, The Heart Bleeds, The Head Rests? Yeah.
Before we get into that, and I'll, because I can talk really fast, I do want to say, Milena, it never goes away, the fear of creating. And this is like a multi-layered point. What is being an artist if we are not recognized during our career, but then we think about writers, and I hate to use pejoratives like Charles Bukowski. There's also a documentary out there, and I can't tell you any details on it because I smoke pot. But it's about a painter who was doing this kind of really morbid work. He was a janitor at a school, and he had thousands of paintings. And I know Ricky's seen this because I can see it in his eyes, but none of his work was found until he died. Like he died, they pulled him out of the room, and all of a sudden thousands of these morbid paintings. And it was very like almost 14th century Baroque and depressing. And you realize how much creativity was held in the back room of a high school where a janitor was living. And later in life, that affects hundreds, thousands of people, you know, same with old, you know, Hank Chernofsky. It's, we didn't start writing or painting or creating because we wanted to get famous. That's rock stars, and like kudos to them. But like for poets, for short stories, for painters, we started writing or creating or producing because it was the only thing we could do, normally with the pain of existence, normally with a retribution towards our trauma, who we used to be, and those kind of growths within ourselves. And always hold that true to who you are as an artist, because that's actually all that matters. It doesn't matter who sees it. It doesn't matter if it goes nowhere. Create from that little id, that spark, that bit of ego and self-deprecation that you have, and then edit and do the best you can. And one day someone will love it, or they will hate it, or they'll never see it. But at least you created something, because I think that's all we have. So that never ends. I've been doing this for far longer than I'd like to admit, because then you'll know how old I really am. It never ends. Maybe one day when I've been published through somebody else, I'll have a little bit of ego towards it. But there's nothing without that fear and without that doubt in ourselves. On that note, I'll read you a poem. I wrote this earlier this year. And it's about the current condition. All right. The heart bleeds, the head rests. We toss our sexual fantasies into personal fountains of delusion with dead arms, tired from masturbating our fiscal stocks into depleted husks. All our base belonged to him, the man on the giant throne marked 1%. He rides a golden Harley through puddles of our 7-day all-inclusive vacations. His mega yacht queefs into the throats of our long-term low-risk investments. So we bank on physical joy as our heads rubber band through the hurdles of couponing and polyamory. How could one afford to not be monogamous in a time like this? So the heart sits on a styrofoam plate in the fridge beside the meatloaf we promised we'd reheat until it becomes the ash of Vesuvius, slowly turning to rot on our tongues. And the head, given off-brand Ativan, obsesses over the noise the TV makes when we finally turn it off. The echo of the man in the giant throne, laughing endlessly. And how far we have never come, his Wagyu-flavored tears spreading heart disease as holiday joy. We practice the 24-step dance routine you make before the bank takes the house. 1, 2, all our base are belong to you.
I think we need to hear this. thank you. It's really lovely. I think I was very touched by the poem because I think you're one of those writers who put a lot of personal truths into your writing. And what you said earlier about taking that little bit of self-deprecation and weave it into your writing, I think I hear that a little bit here. And then a lot of things that you write, I read pain or perhaps some kind of like a wound, but already healed, not completely. So I think here too, that there is a sense of wanting to become something, but there is also powerlessness in that wanting to become. I don't know if that is truthful to your experience or how you think about the poem. Yeah.
I find that over the last 2 years, everything I've written has been about one thing only, and that is the inability to succeed in every way in life at some point in time. This one is, I have like 5 that fit into this, and it's just, it's all about being broke, being a slave to the man or the system or capitalism. It's all about addiction, because at the end of the day, now that we've become more self-aware to the modern world, it's not just the people who are drug addicts. We are all addicted to something, whether it's, especially post-COVID, it is the television that gave us warmth for 2 years while we weren't allowed to leave our homes. It is the high caloric snacks that we can't get over, or it is the attachment to other people to validate ourselves. And so, yeah, there, all of my writing is about pain. Sometimes it's funny, which is great. Other times it is not. But I think that mother wound, as they call it, is, I have to hold on to that, because there's maybe been moments in my life where I was doing really well and like had a partner and was really employed. And I was like, I don't need to write because everything's going really well and there's no pain in my heart. So there's no ink in my pen. And so I think that what you said earlier, and it's a lot of self-deprecation, not a little bit, that is what holds true to being that spur that kind of pushes us forward, where at some point in time, we can sit there and feel sorry for ourselves, and other points in time where you're like, I think I have something here. I can do something with what I have. Let's see what I got.
I mean, you know, like, what is to make anything without self-examination or like self or to pass through your lens, right? Like, I think that in a lot of ways, what we do in design and poetry and is we are just, we're prisms that refract the light of what is real and then share the kind of what, how it breaks out with the world through your art, right? And so, and that's a really, I think that's a beautiful gift you can give people, for one, right? Because it allows different, it allows different things to exist at the same time. It allows for kind of for magic to be real for a second, right? Because it illuminates parts of what you do see, what makes everything. But you get to see it kind of in kind of a new, more detailed way, maybe more nuanced way, or even not even that. Maybe it's like the most abstract, and like right now, my design work has been like probably the loosest that it's been in years, and I enjoy that. I'm really enjoying that to answer that feeling of like, this is what I want to be doing right now. This is how I want to represent the world. Right? Because to some degree, that's all we ever do when we create.
Yeah.
I think, yeah, we do what we do because we want it to feel alive in a way, even though that liveliness or happiness is momentary, as we all know it, we can still try to search for it, you know, and then we perhaps will bump into places that are bright along our path. And I think perhaps publishing or hosting a panel like this is one form of uniting ourselves and collectively find a reason for existence in a way. I feel fulfilled just sitting here and listening to you. And even though our encounter is momentary, I do want to thank you for, at least in this very moment, confirming my existence and giving my my effort a meaningful resting point. So with that being said, thank you all for coming. I really had a lot of fun just having a conversation with all of you. I'll try my best, and perhaps if you have some work that you would like to publish along with this episode, please do send it to me afterwards. But that'll be it on my end. Yeah.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
To all of you.
Thank
it was
you.
Great.
Thank yeah. you so much. I loved being the fly on the wall here. And thank you for that enriching conversation. I just felt very validated, which is a nice feeling. And for all our listeners, you can also find this panel on CADR.ca by searching the show Hail Discordia. Take care, everyone.